Thanks very much. The plan for the session is that I've been asked to speak for about 30 minutes, concentrating on compulsory alternative compensation systems, meaning alternative compensation systems that would be run by a government. And then Wendy Seltzer from the EFF is going to speak about the other main road that we might pursue, which is voluntary alternative compensation systems. The theory out of which this proposal grows is as follows. Informational works are said by economists, accurately, to be members of a special set of products, special small set of products, but an important set of products, which they refer to as public goods. Public goods share the following two characteristics. They are non-rivalrous, which means consumption of them by one person is not inconsistent with consumption of them by another person. And partly as a result, they are non-excludable, or a little more precisely, they're difficult to exclude people from. So once I make a poem available to one person, it's very difficult for me to prevent that person from making it available to 1 or 100 or 60 million additional people. Those two characteristics of public goods create a danger, which economists describe as the danger of underproduction. Unless some collective organization, presumptively a government, does something with respect to public goods, too few of them will be produced in a society because the potential creators of public goods will know that they will be unable to recoup the costs of creating them in the first instance. So things that fall into this general category include national defense, navigation aids, transportation networks, inventions, songs, films, and texts. All right, that's the starting point. So, as mentioned, public goods will be underproduced in any given society unless some collective organization, presumptively a government, does something. Well, what? Well, over the last four centuries, governments throughout the world have experimented with five, and only five, responses to the problem of public goods in different contexts. First of the options is that the governments, under some circumstances, produce public goods themselves. National defense is almost always supplied by a government now. In the United States, space research in most other countries is also funded by a government directly. Government labs carry on the research. Second, governments can subsidize private parties interested or willing to produce public goods. Typically in such situation, government agencies give grants either to universities or other private parties to undertake research that wouldn't be pursued in optimal amounts in the absence of governmental intervention. The National Endowment of the Arts and the National Institutes of Health are examples. Third strategy. Governments can issue rewards or prizes to the producers of public goods after they have produced them. This was an idea pursued vigorously in the 18th century by some of the framers of the American Constitution. It was pursued equally vigorously in Europe, especially in England and Switzerland in the late 19th century, and it's advocated today by some economists, including Stephen Chevel at Harvard and Tanguy van Persele in the Netherlands. Fourth strategy, governments can protect the producers of public goods against competition, guarantee to them that rivals will not make available to the public copies of or works similar to their creations. Guarantees of this sort were commonly issued in the 19th century to producers of private toll roads and bridges. And the last of the strategies is that governments can assist the producers of public goods in increasing the excludability, in preventing unwanted consumers from gaining access to them, and thereby enhancing the power of the producers to charge for access. All right, those are the five strategies, and there are only five. Since the late 18th century, countries in the United States and Europe, less so the rest of the world, have been relying primarily on strategy number four in the context of entertainment. So specifically, copyright law, a premier example of strategy number four, has been our primary way of stimulating the creation of songs, films, and texts. Since 1990, this strategy has been crumbling as a technique, largely, though not exclusively, because of the ease with which people can violate copyright laws by making available through the internet copies of informational works. As strategy number four has begun to crumble, governments in the United States and Europe have shifted increasingly to strategy number five. This is legal reinforcement of encryption or other digital rights management systems. In the United States, the intervention on this line has been the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which in Section 1201 creates substantial civil and criminal penalties for circumventing digital rights management systems. And there is now a comparable EC directive, and many countries, including Germany, have now come into compliance with the EC directive, similarly prohibiting the circumvention of encryption systems or the distribution of technology that facilitates circumvention. It too is failing as a strategy. It's failing in part because, like the copyright system it sought to supplant, it's easily evaded. So, for example, the circumvention technology that's provoked thus far the most litigation is the DCSS system used to unlock the protection for copy protection systems for DVDs. Despite a lot of legal action, the DCSS is relatively easily available over the internet. It also, strategy number five, has substantial social costs. If it were effective, if digital rights management systems backed by legal sanctions were effective, they would cut even more deeply into public regarding rules, like the fair use doctrine in the United States, that protect the public's interest in access to recorded entertainment. So strategy number four and strategy number five have been failing. The theory that underlies alternative compensation systems is, against this backdrop, we ought to reconsider the desirability of strategy number three. Rewards issued to creators. Now, this is a controversial proposition. It's controversial in part because its association historically with socialist regimes, in particular, the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China, both experimented in the context of inventions with this approach. And that association can overwhelm the fact that modern economists also advocate it. As we go through the mechanics of the regime in the next 25 minutes, I'll try to suggest some respects in which the proposal does or does not, is or is not vulnerable to the criticisms often mounted against the socialist versions of this idea. So how would it work? Well, roughly speaking, it would work as follows. The creator of a recording would register an unencrypted copy of it with a government office. In the United States, that would be the Copyright Office. And supply, at the same time, data concerning the duration of the recording being registered and works incorporated therein. The Copyright Office would supply to the creator in return with a unique digital signature, which could be a fairly simple file name. Because for reasons we'll explore in a minute, there would be little incentive under the system to strip them out. The registrant would pay a small registration fee to make the system self-financing. That's step one. Step two is that a government, we're now pursuing to repeat the compulsory version of this idea, a government would raise money to compensate creators through taxes. Before we get to the question of taxes on what, it's important to identify the criterion that would be used in determining the magnitude of the fund, how much money government would have to raise. There are several plausible criteria that might be employed. Some economists prefer this one. We should provide the creators of informational products enough money to pay them the full social surplus of their contribution to society. Although attractive in theory, this would be extremely expensive and so probably politically unpalatable. Some philosophers would prefer a standard of fairness, distributive justice in distribution. The vagueness of this criterion makes it probably undesirable as our template. Instead, more acceptable politically, although theoretically somewhat trickier to defend, is a make-whole principle. We should raise enough money in taxes to make the creators of entertainment whole, to compensate them for the losses they would sustain as a result of authorizing unlimited online distribution and consumption of their works. All right, if we pursue that strategy, how much money would be necessary? Well, to answer that question, you need at least a rough idea of the ways in which money is currently raised in the existing business models in the entertainment industry. Here's the way in which license agreements and revenue streams are organized in the record industry in the United States, and there's a close similarity in Europe. The composer of a song licenses it, ordinarily assigns the copyright in it to a publisher, who in turn licenses it to a variety of organizations, sheet music printers, importers, movie studios, and above all, a record company, who also obtains an assignment of a sound recording copyright, in Europe a neighboring right, from recording artists. The publisher also licenses collective rights societies in the United States, that's BMI, ASCAP, and CSAC, to issue blanket licenses to organizations like radio stations and restaurants. So legal rights in this regime all flow downward and revenue streams flow upward. Which of these flows of money would be impaired if we authorized to repeat online distribution and consumption of entertainment products free of legal liability? These are the ones that would be impaired. A similar analysis in the movie industry would identify these as the primary license agreements in which the creative contributions of novelists, screenwriters, actors, directors, composers, location owners, record companies, and music publishers are all aggregated in the hands of a producer who creates a motion picture and issues a worldwide distribution agreement to a studio, which then licenses a wide variety of organizations, typically in temporally separated market windows, to make them available to the public. Theaters, pay-per-view channels, television networks, video stores, cable companies, record companies, advertisers. Again, money flows upward through this system as a result of the profit-making models of the licensees at the bottom. Which of these revenue streams would be impaired by the legalization of online distribution and enjoyment of entertainment? It's these. By how much? Well, that's a very complicated inquiry pursued in some detail in the book that was mentioned at the outset of this session. Just give you the bottom line. In the United States, the amount that in the first year of its operation of this system, the record industry would suffer is in the order of magnitude of $1.2 billion, that the movie industry would suffer about $500 million in injury. These are using figures from the year 2000. Why the year 2000? Because that's the year at which, just before which, the corrosion of the existing business models began. So this set of figures is deliberately conservative. It's pro-copyright owner in character for the purposes of demonstrating the viability of such a regime. All right, $1.7 billion would have to be raised, but then we have to add to that a 20% charge to run the administrative operation of this regime, plus adjusting those figures for inflation to year 2004 numbers, and you get $2.3 billion. Okay. Where would this money come from? Well, to repeat, from taxes. What kinds of taxes? Well, for a variety of reasons, it would be optimal, socially optimal, to raise the money through an income tax. But that's probably politically unpalatable. Objections in the form of, my tax dollars are paying for pornography, misogynist rap music, and so forth, would probably doom, at least for the immediate future, an income tax. So despite its advantage from the standpoint of distributive justice and economic efficiency, the more plausible approach is a tax on devices and services that consumers use to gain access to and enjoy digital recorded entertainment. So what are those? Those are consumer electronic equipment, like CD burners or MP3 players, blank media, like blank CDs, and digital audio tapes, and above all, broadband internet access. When you add up the amount spent, again, for these purposes, I'm using the figures in the United States, but they're probably going to end up with similar rates if you apply the figures to Europe. When you apply to this tax base the need to raise $2.3 billion in revenue, you discover a tax rate of approximately 11%. By far the most important of the targets of that tax will be broadband internet service. So to bring this down to nitty-gritty, the average broadband subscription weighted by the frequency of DSL or cable modem access in the United States is $45 per month. Implementation of this regime would require, in the first year of operation, charging each broadband subscriber an additional $5 per month, a total of $60 per year. So I'd anticipate a theme we'll get to in more detail in a minute. Currently in the United States, the average household spends $470 per year for access to recorded entertainment, audio and video. Under this system, the household would be able to obtain, through a household broadband service, access to unlimited amounts of entertainment, ad-free, for $60. Vastly cheaper. That, however, as one might expect, overstates the advantage of this approach somewhat because it's using figures in the first year of its operation. A fairer comparison would be, what would be the charge per household of such a regime if it fully displaced the existing mechanism for distributing audio and video recordings? If the CD industry and the DVD and VHS sales and rental industries disappeared, then the number, using again very conservative assumptions, is somewhere between $200 and $250 per household per year. The net effect is this system in operation would cost consumers roughly half of what they currently pay for access to entertainment, and what they would get is unlimited access to audio and video recordings, unencumbered by digital rights management systems or ads. All right, there's some fancier variations on these taxes, Ramsey pricing systems and so forth, but I think they're unnecessary to go into for the time being. The biggest challenge, the most complex, troublesome issue in the implementation of such a regime is, somewhat surprisingly, is how to distribute the money. The criterion here, the right standard to use, is distribute the money in proportion to the relative value to each consumer, or to consumers in the aggregate, of entertainment products. Why is this the right criterion? Because it alone provides appropriate signals to creators concerning what consumers want. It's fair, and it minimizes the hazards which lurk in this system, of governmental involvement in the determination of the merits of different works. All right, that's the criterion. Artists get paid to the extent consumers like the things they produce. It's the same principle, consumer sovereignty, that underlies the current market regime. But it would be implemented differently. So more specifically, instead of charging for access to works of entertainment, under this regime, a government agency would estimate the frequency with which consumers consumed, meaning listened to or watched all the way through recordings. In some contexts, that's fairly straightforward. So to the extent that we are increasingly shifting in this new technological environment to streaming as a mechanism for delivering entertainment products, then counting is easy, because you just require the streamers to keep track of what they're streaming and the number of people who are receiving those streams. Webcasters already do this. So assembling this data would be easy in the streaming context. For CD burning, it's somewhat harder. Here you'd need to combine sales data with surveys to ascertain the frequency with which particular genres of recordings are conventionally copied. The hardest problem in this area, the zone where the most difficulties lie, involves downloading, counting consumptions of downloaded entertainment. It will not suffice in this regime to count downloads themselves. Why? Because there are three ways in which download counts are distorted estimates of consumption. Consumers frequently download music or films to try them out. A study by AT&T in the heyday of Napster suggested that a majority of songs downloaded through the Napster system were listened to less than once, meaning that the consumers got halfway through them or a few seconds into them and discarded them. Download counts also would neglect, like the current system, would mimic the imperfection in the current regime of failing to take into account the differences in the frequency with which consumers play back different recordings. And finally, last but not least, counting downloads is susceptible to the hazard of ballot stuffing, in which artists have an incentive to use various technological devices to exaggerate the frequency with which their materials are consumed by consumers. So what's the solution to these difficulties? Well, there's no single simple solution, but the best one would likely be a large-scale sampling regime in which large numbers of households selected at random would be asked to permit their consumption choices to be tracked by software, open source software distributed as plugins associated with media players that would report consumption counts to a central government agency at regular intervals, in which the data would be aggregated before it would be available to any person in a fashion that would be protective of the privacy of the sampled households. That's the overall framework, but there are many difficulties that lurk in that simple description. Okay, so having assembled this information, you would combine it with estimates of the duration of each work and use the composite to determine how much each registrant received of the $2.4 billion. Then, once that payment system were in place, you would reform the copyright regime. So it's very important in this environment to see that an alternative compensation system is just that. It's an alternative to copyright. It's not like the charges that are currently levied in many European countries, including Germany and Canada, in which taxes of this sort supplement the existing copyright regime. Rather, under this arrangement, copyright law would be modified so as to permit unlimited amounts of reproduction of musical composition, sound recordings, and motion pictures, and public performance of them via digital audio transmissions. Okay, the advantages of such a regime are substantial, but there are also some disadvantages. The advantages for consumers are first, as I've already mentioned, large cost savings. They would gain access to unlimited amounts of entertainment. They would not be susceptible to price discrimination, a coming wave of marketing regimes that digital rights management will enhance in the next couple of years. Price discrimination would be non-existent under the system. And last but not least, the recordings they received would come unencumbered with technological restrictions, enabling consumers to rework them and redistribute them freely. For artists, the advantage of this regime would be a reliable source of income. In fact, they would be compensated better than they are under the current business models. Individual artists would be able to distribute their work directly to consumers and be less dependent upon the major intermediaries of record companies and film studios, because under this regime, they would have a viable business model enabling them to make money by making their works available directly to consumers. Much expanded opportunities to create derivative works. There is, however, a moral rights concern here. Some artists are likely to be troubled by the loss of control over the integrity of their works, a concern especially powerful in Europe. If that concern remains strong, one might imagine constructing as a second, less lucrative track, an opportunity for artists who wish to avail themselves of the advantage of this regime but not make their work susceptible for modification by others, a kind of reverse creative commons here, a second track for artists who wanted to preserve their moral rights. The suppliers of devices and services that gain access to recorded entertainment would be hurt, first, by taxes, which would diminish the demand for their products. On the other hand, the value of their products would be enhanced by the availability of much larger sets of entertainment, and so one would expect in the aggregate they would benefit. Finally, the public at large would gain through decreased litigation costs, decreased encryption costs, and decreased lawbreaking, always culturally corrosive. But there are some substantial disadvantages in this regime. First, the set of people upon whom the tax would be imposed is not going to be exactly the same as the set of people who benefit from this regime. And to the extent there's misalignment, you generate both unfairness and economically inefficient distortions. Such distortions will be more serious in the context of taxes on goods and services than they would be under the income tax. Second disadvantage is, in the compulsory, mandatory version of this regime, there is a fair amount of discretionary governmental power, which is always risky, especially in industries where there are large institutional players who will engage in rent-seeking. Record companies and movie studios could be expected to lobby hard for increasing the size of the pot. And finally, a regime instituted through a government would have to be instituted in the first instance country by country. And to the extent one country took the lead, the regime would leak across national boundaries. Residents of other countries would gain access through the internet to free recordings whose creation was being subsidized by residents of the first country to implement it. An awareness of that likely trajectory would make it more difficult to implement such a regime politically. All right, so the disadvantages, the hazards are substantial. Some can be mitigated through the design of the software through which the regime is implemented, but they can't be made to go away altogether. But against the backdrop of the enormous advantages of such an approach, as compared to the current copyright system, these risks seem worth running. Is it likely that any government will, in the foreseeable future, adopt such a regime? No, not until its practicability has been demonstrated. And that's the best case for launching such a system in the first instance, not on a compulsory basis, but through a voluntary subscription model. And that's the approach that Wendy Seltzer is going to address. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Terry Fisher. Are there any immediate questions of understanding, raised by Terry's talk. The kind of the more fundamental ones we would prefer to take afterwards in discussion, but immediate questions. Could you please use the microphone?
Hi, David Bovell from London. How would you describe the difference between what you're proposing and the BBC license fee?
The principal difference is that the BBC licensing arrangement, as I understand it, does not incorporate the principle of consumer sovereignty. So I tried to emphasize in my talk, the importance of preserving in this new environment the principle that artists would be compensated not on the basis of the decision of a government agency or a private nonprofit organization concerning the aesthetic merits of their programs, but rather on the basis of demonstrations by consumers of what they want to listen to and hear. And the BBC system, because it's a tax that goes to a single organization, the BBC, doesn't incorporate, so far as I understand it, the principle of consumer sovereignty. And that, among other things, is what contributes to its controversial character in England. Do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I agree to a certain extent, but certainly the statistical techniques they use in order to direct their funding to programs are very similar to the ones you're proposing.
Well, if they... in practice, approximate, as I've suggested, a standard by which creators are compensated exclusively on the basis of the popularity of their works rather than on the basis of the judgments of an intermediary, then they would seem similar in operation.
Hi, I have a question of clarification. You said that, or in your calculation, you showed that you have such and such amounts of profit or turnover, this is going to be the question, that have to be compensated for. And then on the consumer side, consumers would save about half the money that they are already, or as of now, spending for entertainment media. Now, there's a gap. Where does it come from? Does it come from lower distribution costs? And if so, as one part, if so, doesn't that mean that, for example, in retail, you would lose a lot of jobs? That would mean that there are social costs incurred by that.
It's a very good question. The answer is yes. Most of the cost savings come through the elimination of several layers of intermediaries. So we'll use the record industry for the moment, because the figures are easier to see there than in the film industry. Currently, approximately 38% of the cost of a CD goes to the retailer, and 8% goes to the manufacturer of the physical object, the CD. Both of those would be saved in this environment because there is no retailer, and there's no need to manufacture a physical object. A full use of the new technologies would also make it possible to realize savings in several other points in the chain because of the advantages of reduced cost of creating high-quality digital recordings and the higher rates of success by individual artists under such a regime, which have the effect of reducing the insurance function of the recording companies. But the largest source of savings is, as you point out, through the elimination of some layers of intermediaries. And to that extent, yes, it's right that there would be social costs associated with shifting to this regime. Some employees of record stores, Blockbuster and so forth in the film industry would lose their jobs. This seems a perhaps regrettable, but inevitable consequence of the advantages of availing oneself of a new technology. Now, here's one follow-up consideration that is suggested by this question. If the largest, not the only, but if the largest sources of the savings by moving to such a regime are realized through elimination of some levels of intermediaries, doesn't it suggest that comparable savings could be achieved by moving to market-based, copyright-based online distribution mechanisms like the iTunes Music Store, Napster 2, Rhapsody, and so forth? So, to put it in the polemical form, it could be suggested that I'm exaggerating the advantages of such a regime by juxtaposing it to the existing business models rather than juxtaposing it to an online authorized market-based regime. To which the answer is, to some extent, that objection is right and salient, but not as much as would first appear, because it turns out that the online authorized distribution channels, iTunes is the premier example, incur new transaction costs in the form of micropayments, which helps to explain why the cost of songs on iTunes currently are, in United States figures, $1 per song. That comes out to $12 to $13 per CD, which is not much below the cost of buying a CD in a store. Why aren't the prices of songs on iTunes lower than they currently are? It's not because the record companies are making a killing on iTunes. They're not. It's because of the large friction created by micropayments. And those friction costs would not exist in this new environment.
How would your compensation system calculate retribution with file sharing? Would this consumer group, which you would like to watch, would you also monitor which files they share, how often files are downloaded from their computer through a peer-to-peer system, or how would this work? Because obviously counting downloads from some music selling site would be relatively easy, but what if I pass along a song via the internet, via file sharing systems?
Yes, this is a good question, and taking into account the importance of music consumption of that form is one of the reasons why I emphasized as the mechanism for this regime consumption counts, not download counts, so that the free plugins distributed to the sampled households would track the frequency with which files shared through peer-to-peer networks are consumed, just as they would count the frequency of the consumption of files distributed through the homepages of artists. There would be no difference in the source of the files. The critical variable is what's played how often. Now, as you mentioned, it would also be possible to, instead of counting consumptions, to monitor peer-to-peer traffic. In fact, Kazaa has volunteered to provide the data necessary to run such a regime. The reason why, even though the peer-to-peer services have volunteered to make available such data, I'm suggesting we not accept their offer is because it would be susceptible to the distortions associated with counting downloads. To repeat, the frequency with which downloaded songs are not consumed at all but are just discarded makes it an imperfect measure of consumers' desires. That's why counting consumption seems a superior approach.
Okay, let's take one last question for this round.
She was first.
Well, my question is, how do you organize the pricing within the system? You said there is a disadvantages of seeking for rent so that the pot gets larger and larger, but within this pot of money, how do you know how much people would like or would be willing to pay for a certain piece of art? How do you do the pricing?
Well, also a good question, and sensitivity to the difficulties lurking in that question is one of the reasons why thus far my proposal is limited to music and film and does not extend to books, photographs, or other images. Why not? Well, because it's one of the characteristics of the music and film businesses that pricing is remarkably uniform. You pay the same for a CD, regardless of whether it's classical music, a solo album, a jazz performance. And you pay the same for entry into a first-run theatrical performance of a film, regardless of whether it's a $100 million blockbuster or a $1 million low-budget item. The prices are relatively constant within each market window. And that circumstance means that replication of standardized pricing in this new environment would be feasible and not terribly distortive. If one imagined trying to extend a system of this sort into the market for fine art or even books, then other difficulties arise of just the sort you identify, that no longer in that environment is it plausible to treat each work as economically fungible. You'd have to devise some other system for permitting the creators to set prices or negotiate prices. Either that or accept the inevitable distortions that would result in different books receiving the same revenue share, regardless of whether one is a easily dashed off self-help manual and the other is a 5-year historical research project.
There's one last question.
Okay, Oliver Moldenhauer from Attac Germany. I have a question. Don't you think your tech space is going to erode with technological advancement? I mean, the amount of money we are going to pay for broadband internet access in 10 years' time, for instance, Waveland development and so on, is going to be very negligible compared to the amount of money you have to raise for the music industry.
Mm-hmm. These are all very good questions. Because the response to this question is that in the immediate future, the next couple of years, the tax base, both in terms of aggregate amount and in terms of the number of people who through the tax system would be charged, is going to go up, not down. And so as usage of this system increased, the tax base would, for the immediate future, be expanding, not contracting, which is fortunate. But you're entirely right that that's only in the next couple of years. And you will see a decline, not in the number of people participating, that will continue to go up, but in the total amount of money after some point. Okay, first response is, to the extent that the, as a result, the percentage, the tax rate, necessarily rises to raise the same amount of money, we shouldn't be troubled, because what we care really about is what each household is having to pay, not whether that payment represents 10 or 20 or 30% of their broadband subscription. It's the total amount. I'm sorry?
Or 200%,
right. The percentage is not the important issue. The crucial issue is the amount. Okay, that's a plausible answer for the medium term. But there may come a point, just to extend your argument, in which broadband services become free. Many people predict that's the likely trajectory of wireless technologies, is our current system of being charged for broadband access will disappear altogether through the elaboration of voluntary provision of wireless systems through individuals or through stores, households, schools, and so forth. So that presents a much more serious issue if the tax base not only shrank but disappeared. And my hope is that by that point, the attractions of such a regime would have been demonstrated sufficiently well that one could shift at that point to the economically and philosophically superior tax method, which I suggested in the lecture as an income tax. You'd have no choice but to shift to an income tax at that point. And the system, having been in place for some years, demonstrated its viability, would be more plausibly shifted to an income tax from a political practicability standpoint. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.